The question that we must ask ourselves as responsible people is, are the vital interests of the United States really threatened? Are the vital interests of the other power constellation in the world, led by Russia, really threatened? Is it really true that we must fight them on everything and that they must fight us on every issue? Or could it possibly be ascertained whether there aren't some vital interests of ours that are not threatened by the Russians, and some vital interests of theirs that are not threatened by us, so that we could proceed to compromise all of these non-vital issues, but hold fast on those that cannot be compromised without losing the values that we cherish most? I do not believe that this scheme has ever been tried, of finding out what our vital interests are and what the Russians' vital interests are. Surely, we can't say that the Dardanelles are our vital interests that we cannot compromise, or that the division of the spoils in Trieste is a vital interest of ours. Nor could the Russians possibly say that our relationship, let's say, with Hawaii or Samoa or some of the Pacific Islands or our Latin American neighbors are vital interests of theirs. I think a thoughtful examination of the situation in which we find ourselves vis-a-vis the Russians would reveal that there are many points on which we can negotiate and compromise without undermining the essential ingredients of our way of life, and that they too can negotiate and compromise on many issues which will not undermine their particular system. Of course, you may say, you can't trust the Russians. Perhaps we can. We did trust them for a while, and for the time being, our trust was not too seriously abused. They may say they cannot trust us either. And what answer do we have to that? But what I am saying is what, of course, makes a person nowadays suspect. It makes one suspect of being an appeaser. And I want to reaffirm here and now, lest I be misunderstood, that I would not appease the Russians on any vital interest of ours. And I don't expect them to appease us on any vital interest of theirs. But what we have been arguing so far as I'm able to see, is not altogether a question of our vital interest. This leads me to raise the question to what our needs are and what our problems are that have been deferred and postponed, and only partway met so far under these adverse circumstances. They are obviously the problems of an ongoing society, and the needs that have been inculcated into us by living in a closely knit democratic world in which the advantages of some soon are translated into appetites by all. If it were merely meeting the physical needs of man, I think we probably could reduce our budget enormously. It's been estimated that most of us could live on a decent, nutritive diet for probably less than 25 cents a day. But nobody would want to eat the stuff. And certainly no one would want to come to the dinner table to have a ceremony about devouring it. But that is not obviously what we want. We want the kind of diet that is attractive that we have been led to believe is desirable, that has been advertised as fascinating, and that has made eating something of a pleasure. When the kids around the dinner table at home in my grandfather's day used to be pretty ravenous, he used to say to us, to halt us back in our appetite, that we don't live to eat. We eat to live. Well, that, I think, was half a fallacy. We also live to eat. And it is this social definition of our needs that counts, rather than the mere physiological definition that matters. Our needs are all those things which we have come to recognize as unsolved problems. And so it is with many other things. So it is with housing and medical care and the general welfare. What about our housing? The American people, as a rule, live in some kind of shelter which is better than that of caveman. People have lived in caves and trenches and huts and igloos and have survived. And they didn't have a housing problem. But they have a housing problem today when we know how to create housing of a quality and a standard that we think is fit for man in our age. Therefore, an advancing civilization inevitably expands the horizon of dissatisfaction. And it is upon that dynamic that our society has grown and flourished. If that ever stopped, you could close your schools of journalism and your advertising agencies and a lot of other institutions that we now support to create the kind of discontent, the kind of problems which will urge men to seek rational or non-rational satisfaction. As we look around the country, what are some of these crucial problems? Well, for the time being, we certainly are still in the stage where even the problems of health have been set back immeasurably by an organized medical lobby that parades under the most pious disguises. We find ourselves confronted by an organization that is spending large sums of money, one of the largest lobbies in the country, one of the most affluent, for the purpose, in a short-sighted, I think, and thoroughly unprofessional manner, utterly unworthy of the profession, holding back an arrangement for the improvement of the health through the medical care of the American people. How long we shall be stymied in that progress, which is necessary to realize our resources to the utmost and to prevent the stunting and crippling of life and talent and order and a decent society, no one can predict. But I think it will last as long as the people of the country do not understand what is going on about them. There is no question about the fact that perhaps our medical care is better today than it was 10 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago, and that perhaps the poorest individual has better medical care than he had then. But that is not the point. The point is that the great potentialities of science and the advance in medical technology is not being distributed to all in accordance with the possibilities and the needs. And the same thing is true of housing. Here we have an effort made in a stumbling sort of way to eradicate the slums of our great cities and of the countryside. And what do we find? The short-sighted people whose own mistaken self-interest leads them to think that any governmental intervention in housing is bad, block the most promising aspect of the development in this field because they do not understand what they are about. When I tell my friends in the real estate business that they're cutting their own throat, they say they must simply stop this trend toward public subsidy. And then when I point out to them that if it weren't for these public subsidies, they would all be out of business, they're astonished. In my city, in Chicago, I have seen almost no housing go up in the last 10 years, which was not in one way or another publicly subsidized. Publicly subsidized through governmental loans, insurance of loans, aid to building and loan associations in various ways, and many other devices that are too remote to be discussed here. There wouldn't have been any housing at all, private or public, if it had not been for these various forms of governmental intervention. And yet, these very same people, in their stupor, fail to see that they are blocking the next great advance in the improvement of the manner and level of life of our people, and are, in a way, crippling the very private enterprise that they seem to feel is threatened. They are crippling it because if all of these various forms of governmental aid were withdrawn, there wouldn't be anything going on in the private field. What would happen, imagine, if we suddenly canceled all the deposit insurance in the savings bank? If we canceled all the insurance of the building and loan associations, which they enjoy equally with the savings bank? If we fail to give the kind of loans which now make it possible for a man with the investment of $100,000 or less to undertake a project worth $1 million. Obviously, enterprise would be completely paralyzed. We have arrived at a point nowadays where some people feel that government ought to take all of the risk and ought to turn over the profits to a private entrepreneur whose only justification for claiming profits is that he does take some risk. Since I'm speaking in an area surrounded by farms, I might say that the same problem holds in the agricultural field as well. And I am not against agricultural subsidies, although I think they could be rationalized and made more consistent with a sound national policy than they now are. For every problem that we face, whether it be housing or medical care, we find an organized group within our own society exerting pressure to the utmost, and often in a most suicidal and unrational manner, to block the efforts at progress. What is true in the case of health, housing, is of course equally true, though we don't often suspect it, in the field of education. The hope for the equalization of opportunity in education on the part of all of our people, and for developing each to the maximum of his talent, is frustrated not so much by organized opposition to educational appropriation, but to minor quarrels within the country, especially the tying up of the problem of education with religion in the face of our tradition of the separation of church and state. And yet it is a fact that this fission within our society at the present moment seems to block a rational nationwide program that would have immense benefit for all. The same thing is true, of course, in the field of welfare. I think we ought to see, if we look at these problems in the light of our resources and in the light of our possibilities, that unless they are met, and met promptly, in the domestic field, we will be losing one of the great magnets which draws people elsewhere in the world to an appreciation of this system of a free society and a semi-free economy, because it's never really been free, not from its very beginning, even. And the answer to these people of other lands is certainly not that these problems do not exist. The answer is they do exist. But there are some people in the country, organized and unorganized, who are trying to do something about it. That is the only honest answer that we can give. Anything else would be a fraud and would soon be discovered. Here is an area of life in which we have more progress to make in the next few years than we have in all the other areas that I have mentioned. The question is, how shall that progress be made? Well, in some areas, the progress has come through progressive enlightenment. It has come in many parts of the South. It has come in the armed services. At least it has come in the Navy and the Air Force, though it is coming much slower and reluctantly in the Army itself. It is coming in the administration of justice. It is coming in higher education. It is coming, and has perhaps come earlier, in the field of welfare. And nothing helped as much to bring it about as the decade of the Depression, when these programs were started under federal auspices. There are only really four ways in which we can affect that problem. One way is to modify people's attitude. Well, I'm not too sanguine about that procedure, because immediately people will tell you, this is the task of education. And since I'm supposed to be in that field and a little tired professionally, I say, I can't wait for the 2 millennia that it would take to educate the people to the point where they would be without these pernicious prejudices of race, creed, and color. So while I'm willing to do my share, although I have my doubts about its efficacy, I'm willing to say, let us educate. Change attitudes of people as far as we can by bringing them facts, and by enlightening them and controlling their sentiment. Another way that people suggest is to change personality. They assume that the people who are responsible for the perpetuation of these ideas are certain pathological people or certain types of personality. And so they would go about changing the personality. They would say a Hitler was a pathological personality, or a Mussolini was that. Or they may say a Stalin is that, or a Gerald L.K. Smith is that, or a Father Coughlin is that. Well, I can't quite believe that. Not that I don't think some of these people were pathological. But if Hitler, at a certain point in his career, had perhaps been given a decent job, which he wasn't, if he had been able to lead a domestic life of tranquility and satisfaction, if he had lived in a stable community that offered opportunities and outlets for his restlessness and energy, I would not be in a position, nor would anybody else, to predict what might have become of him. And the same thing is true of everyone. And the point is, anyway, if it is due to certain kinds of personalities, which I cannot believe, then what is the answer? Well, as I've tried to say elsewhere, the answer in that case would be to turn half of the population into psychiatrists to teach the other half and correct their pathological traits. And to parody Vice President Marshall, under those circumstances, the greatest need of the country would be for a good 5-cent psychiatrist. I see no prospect that that will come about in our lifetime. Then there is a third way of dealing with these problems. And the third way is to modify the situation in which people find themselves. After all, the problems of race relations and minorities are not problems by themselves. They happen to involve people of different racial and cultural groups, but they are problems of employment, housing, medical care, education, welfare, justice, and all the things in life that make up our round of existence. And if we change the situation in any one of them for the better, we also cumulatively change them in other directions as well. So it is in the direction of changing the attitudes, to be sure. Perhaps a few pathological personalities, yes, but primarily in changing the situation. And finally, there is a fourth way, and that is to change the norms and the values by which we live. By that I mean, for instance, to set up certain standards which we are prepared to accept and to follow and incorporate them into our laws and our morals. What I am calling for here is a program which is the most characteristic way of dealing with problems in a democracy, a program of legislation. And let me not be misunderstood here either. When I speak about legislation, I do not mean to say that you can pass a law to abolish prejudices. I do not intend such a foolish gesture. We do not deal with prejudices by law. We do not deal with private opinions by law. But we deal with action by law. We deal particularly with public actions by law. It wouldn't do us any good to pass a law stating that all ICE men shall be gentlemen or shall be generous, though some of them no doubt are. But we can pass a law and say that when an ICE man sells us 50 pounds of ice, we will not accept 45 pounds instead, and if he tries to put it over on us, we'll call the police and put him in the hoosegow. That we can do. And law is one of the important measures through which a democratic society can set standards, which are the minimum standards for all, which do not, however, imply a maximum of ambition to be achieved. And in this field, we have much to gain from legislation. Fair employment practices legislation. In those states where it has been adopted, and there are now about 12 of them, has done something to prevent and to deal with cases of discrimination in employment. We have similar things in the field of education. New York State was one of the pioneers in this field. And as far as I know, nobody, either the public or the private institutions, regret the step they have taken. As a matter of fact, the private institutions, and I happened to be on the staff of the commission at that time in New York, the private institution said, well, we would be willing to do it individually if the others did it. And they were secretly clamoring for a law which would make them all do it at the same time. And the same thing applies to department stores and to banks and to insurance companies and to everything else. When we have arrived at a point where something is important enough for us to insist that it become a minimum standard to which all must adhere, then law is the one natural and appropriate means by which to achieve it in a democratic society. And we have now come to a point where, in the world at large, we may soon be asked, at least if we take our preliminary commitment seriously, to subscribe to a doctrine to which a great many people make serious objections. And that is the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in which we have participated in voting it in the General Assembly and in formulating it through the committee that proposed. When that Universal Declaration of Human Rights comes up for adoption in a covenant by the Senate of the United States, I expect at least as much difficulty as I'm seeing this week in the Senate's treatment of the proposed Fair Employment Practices Bill. If we cannot get a Fair Employment Practices Bill passed by Congress, there isn't a ghost of a chance that the Congress can adopt the Human Rights Declaration of the United Nations. And if we were to go back on that, we would betray the best hopes of mankind in the generations to come. That is why I feel that the passage of such laws as fair employment practices laws in the states as well as in the nation, and certainly if we can't get it in the nation, in as many states as we can get it, including Illinois, which has defeated it now twice, is an absolute prerequisite for being able to face the world with a square jaw. I say, these proposals will not cost us anything, and they will gain us much, both economically and morally. They will make our stature in the world grow, and will make our profession of a democratic order seem more genuine to people who now suspect our sincerity. We might ask today, as other people asked a generation ago, as one of our predecessors in the field, Jacob Riis, asked when he wrote How the Other Half Lives. We might ask ourselves, how does the other 95% of the world, or at least 90% of the world, live? Perhaps if unemployment is to increase, and particularly unemployment of people who are college graduates or high school graduates or technically competent, there may be no better way to solve that problem this time than to embark upon a world program of bringing to all the 100% of the peoples of the world, approximately 2 billion of them, as many of the advantages as we now enjoy here. We would not lessen our standard of living. We would not lower our own level of life by doing so. We would simply be employing the talent and the surplus of skill which you can share with others without diminishing your own benefit of it. The 0.4 program is perhaps, as our assistant to the representatives in the United Nations points out, Mr. Ernest Gross, the most important moral equivalent for war. And the sooner it is implemented, the more genuine will be the belief on the part of people who may be doubting what we have in mind when there is talk of imperialism, that we stand for the elevation of mankind to the highest level possible under the present alignment of world resources and skills. But aside from all of these things that we do, there is something more that we need to do more than anything else, domestically as well as in the rest of the world, and to insist that others do as well, and that is not to push other people around, and not to acquiesce when we see others pushing them around. Particularly from a community that has had the advantage of a higher education in larger numbers than any other people in the world. We need to keep our heads. We need to resist hysteria, to resist diversion into futile channels of our energies and enthusiasm. We need to remember that war means the failure of reason and might mean the end of our liberties and of our civilization. And when it comes to the solution of issues and where we stand, let's not first ask the communists where they stand. And let's not make up our minds where we stand until after we have heard of them. Let's not be for something because the communists are against it. Let's not be against something because the communists or their fronts are for it. If we do, then we will let the communists dictate our policies and pervert our traditions. Young Americans, particularly educated young Americans, in this highly precarious epoch, should be especially sensitive to the anguish of this troubled world. And they should be especially effective in calling attention to the easy steps that lead down the road to catastrophe. They must start in their own community. They must be in touch with one another and with the movements upon which the hopes of men everywhere depend. To be sure, they may not enjoy very much political power, but potentially they enjoy a great deal of influence and indirectly political power. Having the advantage of a higher education, above all, they must be the interpreters to their fellow citizens wherever they live of the basic fears and hopes of men everywhere and of the ceaseless struggle to realize the ideals of freedom and justice and equality of opportunity and the significance of man. They need vision and courage and patience, and they need to fight apathy and cynicism. And when I say ideals, that we ought to keep them in mind, that a democracy and its unfinished business means the realization of as yet unrealized ideals, I don't mean to be a utopian.